Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine what happened this week with the run on the fifth largest investment bank, Bear Stearns, and the subsequent sell-off on Wall Street. We'll look at our increasingly stressed economy with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project, and Dr. Galbraith serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. He writes a column called Econoclast for Mother Jones and occasionally writes commentary for many other publications, including the Texas Observer, the American Prospect, and the Nation. And then we will examine whether there is a political subtext behind the IRS-FBI sting that brought down Eliot Spitzer, the Democratic governor of New York. We'll be speaking with Scott Horton, who is a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He is a professor at Columbia Law School and is the author of over 100 articles and is a contributing editor to Harper's, where he covers legal affairs and national security. His Harper's Web blog, No Comment, has been analyzing the legal implications of the case against the New York governor, Eliot Spitzer. And then in the final segment of the first hour, we'll talk about the fact that oil is over $100 a barrel. We'll look into what is driving this surge in the price of oil, to which, as the president has said, we are addicted. And we'll be speaking, of course, with Fidel Guite, who's a graduate of Cairo University and New York University. He's currently the senior vice president for oil and gas research with Oppenheimer and Company in New York. And Mr. Guite, who has a degree in chemical engineering, has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research. He's previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And the New York Times recently described Fidel Guite as the elder statesman and one of the most respected oil analysts in the world. I'm now speaking with Dr. James Galbraith, who I mentioned teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Austin, Texas in Austin. He's also the director of the Inequality Project and chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security. And he writes a column, Econoclast for Mother Jones. And on this, just this last week, of course, the fifth largest investment bank, Bear Stearns, there was a run on that. I guess I'm not sure there's been a run on a bank, perhaps with the exception of the Northern Rock incident in England since the late 20s. But there's a general unease out there, Dr. Galbraith, suggesting that people are starting to wonder whether this economic meltdown is a kind of bottomless pit, and there are echoes of 1929 being bandied about.
Well, it is clearly a very serious situation in the credit markets. I think the Federal Reserve faces an almost exquisite dilemma. It's obviously under tremendous pressure from the banks and the investment banks to cut interest rates as much as possible, as well as to give essentially unlimited credit and loans against these mortgage-backed securities, whose value is very questionable. It may not be worth much of anything at all. On the other hand, as it cuts interest rates, it's also weakening the dollar, increasing upward pressure on oil and commodity prices faced by American consumers, and that's going to have a serious effect on purchasing power for everything else. So we may be in a situation where the instrument that everybody is relying upon deal with this problem is simply not up to the task.
Well, in that context, clearly President Bush appeared not to be up to the task. I think most people were embarrassed by his blithe, cavalier display in New York this week, where he tried to calm increasing jitters, and I think left everybody. I'm not being partisan here. I think this is the unanimous opinion that we have a president who simply doesn't get it.
Well, I'm past being embarrassed by George Bush, and I think, like most of the country and indeed most of the world, we are simply waiting for him to be replaced. And that's obviously a problem, because we have, another 10 months left to go, during which time we will not be able to come to grips with the economic issues, except through, as I say, this rather weak read of the central bank.
So, but we, it seems to that we what we're facing here, or possibly facing here, is a systemic meltdown of the U.S. financial market. In effect, the huge we have a double whammy. We have the credit crunch and the asset bubble collapse. And it seems to me that you could look at this more accurately as a subprime financial meltdown.
Well, the subprime mortgage disaster is certainly at the core of the matter, but it is now, I think, extending well beyond the limitations of that particular phenomenon. That is, as housing prices continue to fall, a great many mortgages which are not, which are standard mortgages, which are not subprime at all, are also going to be going underwater. And as a result of that, you'll see foreclosure rates going up and a general, you know, spreading of the financial problem. More than that, of course, the securitization of all of these mortgages has created an environment in which the largest investment banks simply don't know what their assets are worth. Nobody's willing to lend to them on the basis of that collateral. And as a result of that, you get these recurring waves of financial lockup, which can basically only be unlocked by the Federal Reserve saying we will once again essentially provide unlimited liquidity to these institutions. And that is a you know a rolling problem. It's a problem where there were in which the Fed actually can hold things off for a limited period of time, but then the wave of panic tends to come back. And we're now, I think, in the third major episode of this since last August. So yes, it could be in some sense a world-changing year. In that, in a system which has been based upon the tradability of financial assets that has been developing basically for 30 or 40 years, could come into a crisis from which the policy instruments that we have are not able to extract it.
But it seems to me that it's a little different, this climate. Perhaps it's not if much of what has been brought in since the financial crash in the 30s has been about transparency. It seems to me that this shadow financial system we have, which includes these structured investment vehicles, conduits for money into the market, money markets, the hedge funds and the investment banks, that's where the other shoe might drop, because nobody really has a handle on this. And Bear Stearns was the first run, and we had Carlyle Capital's mortgage branch go under. I mean, do we really know what's happening out there in the world of hedge funds and private equity?
Well, it is clear that for the big financial operators, transparency is for the other guy. Transparency is for the governments of third world countries. It is not for their own operations. And what they have, in fact, is created a system in which they are trading and holding assets whose valuations really cannot be calculated by any standard process. And that means that so long as everybody's willing to buy them and sort of accept them at face value, on faith as being worth something, the system goes along. But once the element of trust and acceptance disappears, the system as a whole is in big trouble. And that's where we are now, clearly in the financial sector.
And that's what happened with Bear Stearns this week.
Yeah,
right?
It's clear. Yeah, yeah. Sure. I should say, though, that the financial sector, a friend of mine, under his signature on his emails, the financial sector is more trouble than it's worth. The financial sector is not the whole economy. The whole economy of the United States has not collapsed, and keeping the whole economy of the United States from slipping into an intractable recession and from having an enormous increase of unemployment is or ought to be a solvable problem. That's a question on which policymakers in Washington ought to be focusing. If financial institutions fail, if they have to be taken over by the government, if they have to be nationalized, as Northern Rock was in the United Kingdom a week or so ago, this is not the end of the world. financial institutions can be reorganized, and regulation can be reestablished to minimize, to reduce the kind of risk-taking run rampant that we've seen in the recent years. And thinking about how to do that ought to be very high on the agenda of serious people thinking ahead for the next 4 or 8 years of the government of the United States.
But if Dr. Galbraith, if private consumption is 70% of the economy, in effect, you've got the downturn in real estate, and you've got as the recession, which I think no longer people are speculating about, you've got defaults on credit cards, auto loans, student loans. The consumer is shopped out. They don't have any savings. They're burdened with debt. They've used their homes as ATMs. Now the value of the home is less than their obligations.
Can you solve this problem? Yes, you can.
Okay.
You could reduce the burden of debts on people. Obviously, lowering the interest rates that they have to pay does reduce the burden of debts. You can clear people's debts and therefore preserve their consumption streams. You can provide employment. You can do the public investment, the infrastructure investment, the planning ahead to deal with issues like climate change, the creation of jobs that will be required to rebuild the country to deal with those issues. And you can provide a fully employed economy for a generation on that basis if you're prepared to take the steps that are necessary. But one does have to realize that things will have to change, that an environment in which financial institutions are basically extending credit on the basis of people's notional equity in their houses is no longer going to be the driving force behind the rise of American consumption and American prosperity for the immediate future. We've overbuilt in the housing sector. Houses have become far more highly priced than is sustainable. People have taken out much too much debt on them, and working out those problems will have to become another major aspect of the policy changes that will be required. Can it be done? Of course it can be done. This is just a question of rewriting contracts and making things which were unreasonable burdens into burdens that can be borne, but it will require imagination and a willingness to take major steps.
Well, it would seem that then we have a president, as you mentioned earlier. You've given up on being appalled at his inadequacy and detachment. So forget about President Bush. Forget about Paulson. What about Bernanke? Does he get it?
Well, Bernanke's a very talented economist, and I'm not close enough to know him to know whether he gets it or not. I think he's a talented economist in a difficult position, and one who's in an institution that's going to be heavily influenced by the immediate demands of the credit markets, and he may not be adequately detached from that pressure. So I'm still reserving judgment on Bernanke's ultimate performance. I think it could be better than it has been, but I'm not prepared to condemn him outright. He's clearly he's in a different category from these guys who were in the in the administration proper.
Hmm. So it makes you wonder though why Clinton and Obama and McCain are working so hard to get this job if they're going to be stuck with this, handed this. Not only are they going to be handed Iraq, they're going to be handed a pretty stressed economy.
Well, you do wonder whether they've thought ahead to this, whether any of them have thought ahead to the situation they're actually going to face. I think 2008 will actually be kind of Indian summer, because I suspect that the tax cuts that were just enacted will have some measurable effect. I suspect the government will increase its spending. Exports are continuing to be quite strong. So if they don't find an actual, two quarters of negative growth, if the old-fashioned definition of a recession this year, I will not be terribly surprised. But the problem that we have is that looking ahead in 2009 and 2010 and so on, these problems are not going to go away. A housing crisis has a long-term inventory problem. The kinds of debt issues that we've just been discussing, if they're not dealt with, they will fester. They will act as a kind of big drag on the economy. And then you will end up also with large budget deficits, which are going to make a lot of people skittish and perhaps less willing than they should be to take the bit in their teeth and do the work that needs to be done to keep people at work and get the remedy the infrastructure and the public investment deficit? Those questions are all going to face the next president, and they're going to be there for years into the next presidential term, whether that's McCain or Clinton or Barack Obama. They're all going to have to think about it. And voters who are thinking about it should be asking themselves, of these three, or ultimately of the two that we'll face off in November, who's got the greater flexibility of mind? Who's got the greater capacity to really come to grips with what the issues are going to be and to move policy in the appropriate directions?
Well, you mentioned the tax cuts. I mean, just this Thursday, the Senate passed an extension of the estate tax, the so-called death tax, and we all know that that was essentially done at the behest of the Mars family through Grover Norquist and his think tank, and they've been very successful. But just to give you, which I think indicates that not just our president is out to lunch, but it doesn't look like our Senate's particularly on top of things. Here they are passing this so-called death tax, and now Senator Kyle's going to come up. He's got a new bill that's just in to increase the tax breaks for the wealthiest Americans with an additional $200 billion in tax cuts over 10 years. This will only favor the top 0.1 of, you know, 10th of 1%. So we still have this bizarre climate out there of while the poor and the middle class are being made homeless, you still have this extraordinary giveaway to the rich.
Well, it is clear that the predator's picnic that we've been on for the last 7 years is got to come to an end. It's clear it's in its last phases, and I'm not surprised that these actions you've just been describing are being pushed right now, because I think that their authors clearly realize that next year they will not be possible. But it is shocking. If we lose the estate tax, we will lose a fundamental element of what has made this society great in the 20th century, since Teddy Roosevelt actually introduced it, an enormous incentive on the part of people who are wealthy, who have accumulated a lot over the course of their lifetimes, to put their resources into the hands of nonprofit foundations, in the hands of universities and hospitals and other social institutions, which absolutely frame the character of modern American society when you compare it to comparably wealthy societies in Europe or Asia. That's our signature. And if we lose that, then the next century will simply be much less of a we will have much less of a functioning middle class country than we do today. And that's the fundamental issue that the estate tax represents. And the fact that there are many wealthy people who favor the estate tax, who have argued strongly against this rapacious attack on it, indicates that they understand this, that this is, you know, the deal that we make with the very wealthy in this country is that you can, in fact, accumulate large sums. But once you've succeeded in doing it, then you have, you should create something with it, something that passes down as an institution to the country as a whole, or contribute to an existing not-for-profit institution. That system has worked very well. I think wealthy people who are against the estate tax, who are in favor of its abolition, are going to pay a terrific political price in the future, as people realize that why not simply tax away their accumulations as they happen? Because after all, what's the point of allowing extraordinary accumulations to occur if they are entirely being used in conspicuous consumption and conspicuous waste?
Well, just in closing, ironically, on the day that Eliot Spitzer hit the scandal broke, the Washington Post ran an op-ed of his, Predatory Lenders, Partners in Crime, which you mentioned the Predatory Lenders picnics over. And just quoting from Eliot Spitzer's article, in 2003, the Office of the Control of the Currency, during the height of the predatory lending crisis, Office of the Control of the Currency invoked a clause in the 1863 National Bank Act to issue formal opinions preempting the state predatory lending laws, thereby rendering the states inoperative. The OCC also promulgated new rules that prevented states from enforcing any of their own consumer protection laws against national banks. The federal government's actions were so egregious and so unprecedented that all 50 states' attorney generals and in all 50 state banking superintendents actively forth the new rules. So clearly the federal government basically stopped the states from doing anything about predatory lending, which has led to this crisis. I mean, this is
exactly so, and it is a tragedy that we are losing Elliot Spitzer over this aspect of his personal conduct, because he was a very powerful voice for pointing out the true character of this administration as completely dedicated to the service of a tiny clientele of extraordinarily wealthy and powerful people and corporations, and completely indifferent to the larger social.
But they were given a license to steal, weren't they? And now we're all.
It's not just in this area; it's in every aspect of public policy under this administration. That's what it's been about for the last 7 years.
Well, on that note, I thank you so much for joining us, Dr. James Galbraith.
Pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking with Dr. James Galbraith, who teaches economics at the LBJ School at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also director of the Inequality Project, and he serves as the chair of the Board of Economists for Peace and Security and writes a column called Iconoclast for Mother Jones. I'm now speaking with Scott Horton, who is a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He is a professor at the Columbia Law School. He's the author of over 100 articles and is a contributing editor to Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's weblog, No Comment, has been analyzing the legal implications of the case against the New York Governor Elliot Spitzer. And as I just mentioned there with Dr. Galbraith, I was just quoting from Elliot Spitzer's op-ed that ironically came out on the day that this scandal broke. Given what he's saying and what's happening to us, it looks as if they've really killed the messenger there, right?
Well, I think there's no question but that Elliot Spitzer is someone that made the Bush Justice Department look bad. I mean, made them look terrible, in fact, while he was Attorney General, because he was able very effectively and very quickly to prosecute some serious economic crimes in the center of the financial industry here in New York. So the Bush Justice Department looked completely lethargic. It appeared to be neglecting things, which in fact it was. And the financial community in Wall Street detested Elliot Spitzer.
But it sounds like if they actively invoked an 1863 law to forbid the states from having any say in predatory lending, if the Fed stepped in, that was a green light to these bottom feeders that have left us holding the bag.
Well, I agree with that. I think that's quite right. And Spitzer really found abuses all across the board. I mean, I think some of the more spectacular things he did had to do with client solicitation in the equity industry, where analysts would publicly make one set of statements about a particular equity, and privately, internally, would describe something as a steaming piece of a word I can't say on the air.
Well, there's been some speculation, very little of it expressed, but I must say, conspicuous among them was James Carville, who, of course, is a well-known Democratic operative. Who's married to a well-known Republican operative. But that aside, he suggested that there's a political motive here behind what happened to Spitzer. So let me try and, if we can, connect some dots here. And correct me, because I may be going off into conspiracy land here, Scott, but just bear with me. One of the most extraordinary things that happened in the law in this country was the testimony of the Deputy Attorney General, Jim Comey, who really he went out of his way to tell this story in front of the Senate. And it was the first time the public learned about what happened. You had the Attorney General, Ashcroft, in hospital, in serious shape because of a gallbladder situation. He had signed over the Attorney Generalship to his deputy, Comey. They then learned through the FBI head and Comey learned that Gonzalez and the chief of staff Andy Card were on their way to the hospital room of the ailing attorney general to force him to sign an extension of whatever it was that they were doing in terms of spying on American citizens, and these two guys, the acting attorney general and the head of the FBI, were prepared to resign if that extension was signed. And they were trying to get this guy to sign it, and he refused to sign it, Ashcroft. Nobody seems to be asking, what is it that they were doing that was so egregious that these two guys, the head of the FBI and the acting attorney general, were prepared to quit over? And is that in any way related to what Bush is so assiduously trying to cover up in terms of giving the telcos immunity? He obviously doesn't want the telcos to go into court and say what they know. And that is why he's forcing the House and Senate to give immunity to the telcos. So let's start there. What do you think it is that they've been doing that they have the capability to do that they don't want us to know about?
Well, I think if we go back to that very, very dramatic scene that Comey described brilliantly in his testimony before Congress, it's fairly clear that, as you say, it's about telecom immunity. It's fairly clear from the circumstantial information we have that that the administration had coaxed the telecommunications providers and internet service providers into collaborating with it and allowing wide-ranging data mining by the National Security Administration, other intelligence agencies, and that this was being done without a court order from the FISA court authorizing it, which means that it was a felony under federal criminal law. And that an effort had been made to expand this process further. That had been reviewed by the Justice Department. The Justice Department had concluded no. But the telecom companies were looking for a piece of paper signed by the Attorney General that they could rely on in continuing to cooperate. Now, John Ashcroft was no longer the Attorney General, actually. He had relinquished his position to Comey while he was in the hospital. So they wanted to get a sheet of paper signed by Ashcroft, who in fact was not the Attorney General, to use to coax the telecoms into collaborating in a project which the Justice Department itself had determined wasn't lawful. It's mind-boggling.
But it had been going on for a number of years.
In one form, had been going on for a couple of years,
right.
Yes.
Right.
And we're talking about some transformation of the program, however slight, that even the Ashcroft Justice Department felt was unlawful. So, you know, there are a lot of details here that haven't yet come out, but one thing that we see consistently is a dismissive attitude towards the law, and that dismissive attitude is linked particularly to Alberto Gonzalez and the new team that he later brought into the Justice Department. I mean, what was the upshot of all of this with Ashcroft and Comey? Both Ashcroft and Comey leave, and a new team come in who are characterized by being enablers, simply. I mean, they do whatever the White House wants. They're not really concerned about legal niceties.
But doesn't Bush want immunity for the telcos because he can't afford this information to come out in court?
Well, I think he certainly has been highly solicitous of the interests of the telecoms consistently. And he wants retroactive immunity, and, you know, I just expressed my delight with the conduct of the House of Representatives this week because they refused to give it to him. In fact, you know, I talked with a couple of Democratic members who, you know, came back from that secret session in which the administration presented what they said was compelling evidence of the need for this retroactive immunity, and all the people I spoke with came back saying there was absolutely no evidence presented whatsoever to justify the case for retroactive immunity or for many of the other changes the administration was requesting.
Well,
so they finally run into a brick wall here. It's about time.
Well, I guess, Scott Horton, the reason I'm referring to this is that I'm speculating here that the government has had an extraordinary ability since 9/11 to data mine. They don't want to tell anybody. They don't want to tell us. They don't want to tell the Congress. They don't want to tell they don't want anybody to know the extent of it. And that's why they're so desperately trying to get immunity for the telcos, because that might be the fissure that leaks out the information about the extent to which the data mining is underway.
Then you've got
the clear implication that Spitzer was caught in a data mining sting, which the IRS began, and then suddenly the FBI comes in, and then they're spending tremendous resources tapping a tremendous number of phones, an ability that's supposed to be there because of the terrorists, not because of political opponents.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think we can start by going back and looking at the statements that Admiral McConnell has been making repeatedly. I mean, he has now said a half dozen times that his agency is looking at communications overseas involving foreigners, non-citizens. And one thing we know quite certainly is that statement is not true. The reference base that's being used, that's being scanned and reviewed at one level, is essentially all telecommunications and all internet service traffic that goes through the country. So it's not very, very narrowly defined. Now, they're using logarithms and things for their searches, and it may well be that they don't probe very deeply into all of these communications, but nevertheless, there certainly is a review at one level that's going through just about everything that's out there. Now, when we come to the Spitzer case, I think it certainly raises very important questions about what I call the national surveillance state. And in fact, my friend Jack Balkin, a professor at Yale, has written about this just in the last couple of days. I mean, one of the new aspects of the post 9/11 national surveillance state is a heightened level of scrutiny of all financial dealings, and banks are placed under tremendous pressure to basically do the bloodhound work of the government. And according to the narrative that's come out of the Justice Department so far, which I think is, far from being comprehensive, a suspicious activity report was filed by the North Fork Bank about Elliot Spitzer's financial dealings. It had to do with a series of payments he made, less than $10,000, with respect to which he asked that his name not be used. And this triggered the filing of the SAR, and this then led to the Internal Revenue Service review, and then this launched the prosecution. And the suspicion that was held out at the beginning was perhaps he was trying to hide some sort of bribery payment. But when you think about it, it doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, first of all, the amount of money that was involved here, coming up to $10,000 in one block of payments, might be large for an ordinary person, but Elliot Spitzer isn't an ordinary person. I mean, his father is a vastly wealthy real estate magnate, and Spitzer has all the money he needs. This sort of expenditure for him is frankly nothing. And in terms of money laundering surveillance, the total quantum that was suggested that was involved here was $40,000, and I've been involved in money laundering examinations for many, many years, and I can just tell you that, that's not enough money to raise an eyebrow anywhere. It's an absolutely trivial sum of money. So what's really going on here gets disclosed in some of the later interviews where the Internal Revenue Service personnel say, no, it was the identity of the person who came up. That is, it was Elliot Spitzer. That's what triggered all of our interest and brought the house down, caused a massive fishing expedition to get more information. So it turned into a let's find something on Elliot Spitzer investigation. It was not an investigation of a prostitution ring in which he got caught.
Right, but it's obviously the government's legal filings, which were so gratuitously lurid, they were designed to defame and destroy Spitzer. I mean, I'm not making excuses for his behavior or President Clinton's behavior, but it does seem, as the star thing was, that it's a sign that the government is the pornographer here. They're foisting this stuff on us.
Well, I'd say two things separately. I mean, one, as you say, the filings themselves were filled with lurid detail taken from telephone conversations about the sexual preferences and conduct of client number 9. And then the prosecutors and the investigators here were extremely eager to get all of this into the newspapers everywhere. And they leaked the fact that it was Elliot Spitzer, that Elliot Spitzer was client number nine. So it's quite clear. I mean, this establishes a clear political pattern to the prosecution, that is, to destroy the career of Elliot Spitzer. And I would agree with you, by the way, his career is toast, and it should be.
Right.
That's not the issue. But we do have a lot of questions about the prosecutors and how they're behaving, and they're behaving far below the minimum ethical standards governing prosecutors, and they're behaving in a way that demonstrates, I think, a clear and consistent pattern of politically abusive conduct.
Well, it seems, just in closing then, Scott Horton, it seems to me that if you look at the entire inquiry, the Senate inquiry into Gonzalez that finally led to him stepping down, the key player in all that turned out to be Karl Rove, that he, in effect, ran the Justice Department in the sense that Gonzalez really reported to him, and he put his people in there. We know about Monica and all these people from these Christian Bible schools that were put into place there, essentially to do the White House's bidding. And we know that U.S. attorneys they fired were fired because they weren't sufficiently zealous in pursuing political prosecutions, Iglesias, Carol Lamb, or they had the chutzpah of actually doing their job and putting some Republicans in jail in the case of Carol Lamb. So there's no question, and you've also got the Don Siegelman case down in Alabama that 60 Minutes recently exposed as political targeting of a Democratic opponent using the law as a political weapon. So it seems to me that in that climate, if that's what Rove set up and made a priority of the Justice Department, then who should be surprised that they find Elliot Spitzer?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, you know, this prosecution has been carried forward by the Public Integrity Section. The Public Integrity Section has emerged as the most politically corrupted part of the Justice Department. It is basically a bloodhound out after Democrats, and we've got a lot of statistical evidence, 5.6 Democrats being prosecuted or cases being opened for every Republican during the Bush administration. So it fits right into it, and I think even if we look at this question of political figures tied up in prostitution rings, we've now got two major cases in the country. We have this one in New York, and we have the case of the so-called D.C. Madam in Washington. That case involved a sub-cabinet officer of the Bush administration, the head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, and a Republican senator, David Vitter. Now, what's the prosecution's attitude been there? It has been basically to soft-pedal and to suppress any information coming out about those two political figures. Exactly 180 degrees opposite from what is going on in the Elliot Spitzer case. No suggestion of any criminal investigation of the two of them, and refusal to confirm any information. In fact, they've gone out of their way. They've turned somersaults to obscure the fact that these two political figures are smack in the middle of the case. And that shows a double standard. That is, it's aggressively vetted to the media when it involves a Democrat, and it's suppressed when it involves a Republican.
And in Spitzer's case, they still haven't let him off the hook, right?
I mean, well, in fact, the reporting from the last 48 hours in New York shows that they are aggressively looking at a whole series of different attacks on him involving campaign money, use of public office, and, of course, this all rests on the Mann Act in this case, a 1910 statute, the White Slavery Act of 1910, which is probably the single most disreputable criminal statute in American history.
Right, and the idea that they would use that you know, women, white slaves crossing state lines, I mean, as if this woman didn't do it as a part of her service. I mean, they should be prosecuting her, not him. I mean,
no, and indeed, I think most criminologists would look at this and would say there is a sort of prostitution that merits being aggressively looked into. That is particularly where the prostitutes were abused. That's not the case here. I mean, these sort of high-end call girl things are essentially a classic victimless crime.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Scott Horton, and I hope some investigation is done by the mainstream press into this obvious linkage between the extent to which the government data mines, the extent to which Karl Rove politicized the Justice Department and turned them into a witch-hunting arm of the White House to politicize crime, and the extent to which Spitzer is the poster boy for their efforts.
Well, great to be with you today. I hope so, too.
Thank you.
But I'm not expecting it.
Thank you again, Scott. Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Master. Just speaking with Scott Horton, a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, and he writes, contributes to Harper's magazine, writes on legal affairs. His Harper's weblog is No Comment. I'm now speaking with Fidel Geit, who is a graduate of Cairo University and New York University. He is currently the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research with Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. Mr. Geit, who has a degree in chemical engineering, has more than 30 years of experience in oil and gas research. He has previously been with Mobil Oil and the J.P. Morgan Company in New York, and the New York Times recently described Fidel Geit as the elder statesman and one of the most respected oil analysts in the world. So, Fidel Geit, with oil at over $100 a barrel and creeping up, what is driving this surge in the price of oil to which, as our president has said, we are addicted?
Well, its excessive speculation over the last 6 months to a year, sinking U.S. dollar because of our effort to continue to cut interest rates. And we know beforehand that since the dollar is counterweighting the direction in oil price, we knew that if we continue to sink our dollar, oil prices will eventually go higher, and that's exactly was the case. But in the last year or so, because of the collapse and obviously the subprime debacle and real estate meltdown, the financial institution bailout, and all these things, all investors are looking for now a safe haven against the deterioration in the value of the dollar and possible rise in the rate of inflation. So commodities and oil in particular became an attractive asset class, and that attracted a lot of money, not only from this country, from all over the world. So you see oil, platinum, copper, even foodstuff, wheat, barley, and so forth. So the commodity play is taking place right now, and oil is spearheading the effort because of all the political and geopolitics that goes with it, and because of continued economic growth outside of the U.S., and since they are not hurt as much by rising oil prices because they pay for it in stronger currency, it's not really impacting them as negatively as it's impacting us.
So, Fidel Geit, if OPEC itself believes that 30% of the $100 a barrel price of oil is caused by financial speculators, and that the real price of a barrel of oil is about $70, I understand that there's something happening here, and see if you think I'm on the right track. If these big sovereign funds like Russia and the Emirates and the Saudis, et cetera, and the Kuwaitis, who obviously are piling up money because of the oil, that's a big part of their portfolios. So is it possible that the sovereign funds that are out there are, and I believe there's evidence to this effect, they're investing in the oil futures with their own profits, and by running up the price of oil in a self-fulfilling kind of way?
Absolutely. And the culprits here actually are the largest 12 financial institutions in the world. The biggest players in this field are Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs. These are the guys that are driving oil prices by creating this financial instrument that is basically a new asset class. that's attracting a lot of money from the Middle East, from China, from elsewhere. All these countries that are sitting on piles and piles of dollars that are depreciating before their eyes, they have no other choice but to seek at least safety of principle and or the preservation of capital. And these are the financial institutions that are providing them this vehicle, if you will. It's basically to kill two birds with one stone, mitigate the impact of the lower dollar and the impact of higher rate of inflation.
But it's a kind of win-win for them, isn't it? The more money they make out of oil, the more money they can game the oil market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it's not by design for us to go and blame OPEC for what is happening to us. Obviously, they did not create our subprime debacle. They did not create the real estate crisis. They did not create any of these things. Now we're seeing what's happening. The government is bailing out Bear Stearns. The government basically bailing out financial institutions that made blunders and mistakes in the hope that the Fed will ultimately come and bail them out.
Well, you've been quoted recently as saying, that OPEC is angry that George Bush wants them to increase production while the dollar is sinking and the administration is doing nothing about it. It's really not surprising that they have ignored him.
Absolutely. I mean, the president went publicly and privately, went to the Saudis and the other Arab countries that are quote-unquote our friends and allies, and asked them to open the spigot. And guess what? They said there's plenty of oil in the market. Demand growth is slowing, which are all facts. For example, here's our president going to Saudi Arabia and asking specifically for more oil to be put on the market. And he's turning around and telling him, Mr. President, the refining system in the U.S. is cut and run on purpose because there is a glut of gasoline in the market. So why would you need more oil to exacerbate the current glut? Obviously, if that is the case, and any slowdown in economic growth, you could have a 1998 deja vu, and oil prices could go down by as much as 70%.
So presumably, Vice President Cheney, I believe, is in the Gulf now as we speak, or he's just left. Is that what he's trying to do? Is he trying to twist their arm?
Well, I mean, twisting their arm is not going to work. I mean, you
right.
have to understand.
Well, you've just explained why, that it's total hypocrisy on our part. We have systematically closed down refineries and made them a choke point as a way to drive up price, haven't we?
Correct. That's correct. Again, I mean, OPEC has no control over what we do in this country, from environmental law, from specification, from any other thing. I mean, they don't issue permits for companies to go and drill elsewhere, to build pipeline, to drill, to build capacity. So we choose the strategy. We have our own strategy. We have our own policies. We want to have the cake and eat it too. And unfortunately, most of our policymakers and you know, people who are in charge of government, they have dangerous combination of arrogance and ignorance. They just do not know sometimes what they are talking about, and in many cases, they ignore facts. And the rest of the world look at us as a bunch of fools. I mean, we are creating our own problem, but we want other countries to come and solve it for us.
So, Fidelga, what would it take to prick this bubble and bring oil back to a much more realistic price if OPEC says it's at least 30% above what it should be?
2 months ago, I testified before the Senate, and I was very surprised that both Republicans and Democrats were on the same wavelengths, if you will, seeing clearly that the speculators have seized control of the oil markets. But guess what? They could do nothing about it. So either the government is incapable of fixing the problem or purposely ignoring the problem. And either one is just one is worse excuse than the other. We have a problem. We just do not have an energy policy. We think an energy policy is by getting our hands on a country that has oil resources. That is not an energy policy.
Well, that's certainly not working out, is it? I mean, look at the front page story in the New York Times today. We learn that the stolen oil profits keep Iraq's insurgency running. Here we have, remember the one of the rationales for this war put forth by Richard Pearl and Paul Wolfowitz and Douglas Feith? It would be self-financing. Iraqis would rebuild themselves on their oil revenue. Now we learn that it's not, it's the insurgents who are rebuilding themselves on the oil revenues.
Someone really is taking hard measures, taking this war. I really think after this administration is out in the sunset, we should have really a tribunal to look at the Iraq war, because I believe there has been a lot of war crimes committed in the name of the American people. This war has been wrong, continue to be wrong, continue to drain our resources. It is not building any goodwill. It's not building any democracy in the country. It's just creating more hatred for America, and everything we have done over the last 50 years in this part of the world is turning very sour.
Well, I think, Fidel Guide, I think you can fairly say that it is very clear that the Iraq war is not being fought in the national interest. It's being fought in the corporate interest, and the only winners so far in this war, the Iraqi people have lost up to 1 million of their citizens. We've lost close to 4,000 of our soldiers and many, many thousands more permanently damaged for life. Yet the only people that seem to have won so far are the Halliburtons, the contractors, and ExxonMobil and others. So,
well, actually, I will have to say it's only the Halliburton, because the oil companies have not been able to put their hands on one barrel of oil. I mean,
it's
they
true,
have
but
not been any closer to it.
But there's a theory, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that it actually serves those who want a higher price of oil to keep Iraqi oil off the market, because as long as it's off the market, you know, the second largest producer could drop the price, and that a higher price in oil per barrel, as it clearly Exxon's had record profits,
too much of a good thing is a bad thing. One thing that I can tell you, and oil companies can see that clearly, it's a double-edged sword. Higher oil prices have clearly shifted the center of power away from the hands of the international oil companies into the hands of the national oil companies, the Petrovices of the world, the Nigerian oil company, the Russian oil companies,
right,
all these things. They are in control.
And that's what has led to these new sovereign funds, right?
Absolutely.
Well, I thank you so much for filling us in on this. It's at the heart of everything, it seems, and so often we don't connect the dots. And I'm so glad that you joined us here today, Fidel Guide.
It's my pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Fidel Guide. He's a graduate of the Cairo University and New York University. He's the Senior Vice President for Oil and Gas Research at Oppenheimer & Company in New York City. And he's previously been with Mobil Oil and J.P. Morgan Company. And the New York Times recently described him as the elder statesman of the oil analysts. And I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, Elliot Fong, Lichtuan, the assistant producers, and Nadia Richardson, the engineer.